From the Mom Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Mark Ridley Thomas has served in the California State Senate and Assembly. He's most recently been an L.A. County Supervisor, and now will go back to his first job in local politics as an L.A. City Councilman. Now, considering that the job will be open in 2 years, we'll hear if he's eyeballing the mayor's office next. Plus, are the Oscars ready for they and them? It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I mean, Martinez, thanks for joining us today. Coming up.
So it's kind of like you're like a doomsday predictor, and you're trying to pick like the worst case scenario. And then, are you still safe?
Yeah, it's dry. Southern California is again under a red flag warning. We'll hear from firefighters about how they prepare, you know, in case things take a bad turn. That's ahead. But first, one of the new faces coming to LA's City Hall is a familiar one. Mark Ridley Thomas is leaving his seat on the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors to join the City Council once again, representing the 10th District. The veteran politician sat on the council the first time back in the 90s, and he returns to City Hall at a critical time when Los Angeles and the nation are facing some of the biggest challenges in our history. So for an exit interview on his time on the county level and what to expect when he transitions, Mark Ridley Thomas joins us. Now, you've spent three terms on the City Council back from 1991 to 2002. Why go back to that role?
Well, this is a different moment in time, at the highest moment of its crisis with respect to homelessness. I feel that a significant amount of work is yet to be done, and I have a sense that I'm uniquely qualified and experienced to help shape what that looks like, and I appreciate the opportunity.
You mentioned homelessness. What will you be able to do, or what do you think you'll be able to bring from your time on the Board of Supervisors back to the City Council, considering, as you said, this is a very different time from when the last time you were on the council?
At the state level, at the county level, and the city level, I've been very active in trying to construct new and forward-looking ways to address this crisis. For an example, if you look at the community of Leimert Park, if you look at the community that surrounds Venice and David Boulevard, when you look at the communities that are part of Koreatown, we have already begun to look at each one of those areas as a part of constructing models with service intense outreach.
But Supervisor, you know, we've talked to you about this before. We've talked about homelessness. You and I have sat down. I've gone to places out in the city with you to talk about this. And despite all the solutions and all the possibilities and scenarios that we've all thrown at it so far, from raising sales tax to spending billions on homes and shelters, the problem has only grown. And that was before the pandemic made it worse. Why is this happening? Why is there seemingly no solution, at least coming from our leaders, on a way to make a dent in this?
Bluntly stated, we haven't worked hard enough, we haven't worked smart enough, we haven't worked fast enough. And my hope is to put a fine point on that in my return to the City Council. So frankly, the first order of business is to articulate a higher order of consciousness and urgency. I'm hardly uninitiated in having to motivate people to do the right thing. Seeking to put colleagues on blast does not work. We have to articulate a much higher level of collaboration between the city of Los Angeles and the county of Los Angeles. Secondly, we would have to find more resources and methodologies to intervene with respect to mental health and substance use therapies, treatments, and supports. And finally, we have to get on with the issue of housing. And so there is a compendium to which we have to appeal in order to tackle this problem. The difficulty is that which we have done is insufficient.
We're talking with Mark Ridley Thomas, who will join LA's city council representing the 10th district. On the note of inviting colleagues to roll up their sleeves, the council right now is much different than it has been in the past. I got an incoming council person, Nithya Raman, who has made homelessness a priority of her campaign. And you've got people like Mike Bonin, who have also faced homelessness right in the face as well. Do you have hope that with the current structure of the city council, that you can get some real work done in this term around when it comes on homelessness?
I do. We do not think about this in a one-dimensional way. We will have to address dueling bureaucracies that need to move to a level of complementarity rather than competition. We have a lot of work to do, and I believe that it can be done.
Now, tied to the issue of homelessness is the pandemic. It's been raging for months, and like so many other parts of our society, it's hitting our disadvantaged communities especially hard, including your own constituents coming up in District 10. What's one victory that you can claim on the county level that actually lessened the burden on them, and how will that possibly translate to your work on the city level again?
Well, the significant lessening of burden with respect to homelessness has been the investment the county made by leading the charge for Measure H, $355 million annually to address the homeless crisis from the vantage point of services. The infrastructure of the county, from the Department of Public Social Services to the Department of Health Services, that infrastructure is critically important to have a more direct way of moving things forward with the county. All of these constitute the infrastructure, the network, the safety net that has to be built out in order to drive down homelessness from the perspective of treatment, but also from the perspective of prevention.
And the other thing, too, is that there's hardly any money around on the state level, on the city level, on the county level. Money is scarce. So where is that money to do a lot of the things that people want to do or even just give relief to people?
The county of Los Angeles is perhaps the most solvent form of government in the state of California. And there's no denying the fact that the city of Los Angeles is challenged from an economic point of view in terms of its budget. But I take this point, where there is a will, there is a way.
One of the things that I've noticed for you is that policing had become a big issue for you recently. The County Board of Supervisors has had a very contentious relationship with Sheriff Alex Villanueva, and you've arguably been one of his biggest critics, especially in terms of holding deputies accountable for their actions. Wondering if that work now stops because you are no longer on the board, and or will you be focusing that energy now on the LAPD?
My involvement on the issue of law enforcement accountability is really four decades in the making. It is not simply about Alex Villanueva. That is simply the most recent iteration. My commitment is to justice, it's to fairness, it's to racial equity. That's why I've been elected by a constituency that continues to place me in public office, I believe, because they have a level of confidence that I will speak truth to power.
One more thing. You started your career on the city council in the early 90s. Then you moved on to the state assembly, became a state senator, served on the county board of supervisors, now back on the city council. In 2 years, the job of mayor of Los Angeles will be wide open. So I'm wondering if you are interested in becoming or running for mayor of the city. That's the one job that you haven't held yet.
I haven't been sworn in as councilman of the 10th district yet. It seems to me that I need to learn how to do that properly.
But is that something you'd be interested in, to be mayor of this city, considering the amount of time that you have spent as a public servant in the LA area?
It is the case that you'd be hard pressed to find another elected official that has had the length of public service and the diversity of opportunity, but I want you to take me at my word when I say what calls me to this assignment is to figure out how we address the homeless crisis.
When you're ready to announce your mayoral campaign for 2022, just do it on my show. That's Mark Ridley Thomas, who will join LA's city council representing the 10th district. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. It's not just coronavirus that's putting us on the edge. Conditions are ripe this week for massive, uncontrollable wildfires. A strong sand and winds batter our extremely dry Southern California hills, which haven't seen substantial rain since, what, last spring. The National Weather Service in Oxnard has not only issued a red flag warning, but called the conditions particularly dangerous, likening them to the conditions of the Thomas Fire back in 2017. Now, in anticipation, the Los Angeles County Fire Department is sending out strike teams to problem areas so that they can respond quickly to any fire that starts. But what's it like to be on the front lines just waiting for the worst? Last year, KPECC science reporter Jacob Margolis visited one team to find out.
Late one night last October, I drove to Station 89 out in Agora Hills. Winds were expected to hit 80 miles per hour, blowing across bone-dry mountains between the 101 and Malibu, potentially turning any spark into a really big fire. And if that happened, Strike Team 1103 Alpha was positioned there to jump up and respond as quickly as possible. When I arrived, I thought I'd find some sort of intense pre-battle ritual, but I was wrong.
Hi, I'm Jacob.
Jacob, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Even though it was about 9 p.m., they were in their PJs getting ready to sleep.
So we kind of kicked off this event with a nice meal. We had some tacos, beans, and rice. So all the guys got some pretty full bellies. And we're just kind of waiting for this wind event to pop up.
Battalion Chief Steve Cabrera said the prep work had already been done. They'd laid out all their supplies, including brush boots and shirts, as well as goggles meant to protect their eyes from ash. They'd prepped cards with radio frequencies on them so they could talk in the field, and they'd even pulled up maps of the area on the fire truck's GPS, all so they could just wake up from a dead sleep and go.
You know, we always say 1103 is on the tip of the spear. We want to be there first. We want to do as much as we can and try to take care of business.
Engineer Jeff Kimura was looking forward to getting some sleep because he didn't know when he'd next get the chance. Wind-driven fires can get out of control really fast, and they can last for a very long time.
The Wolseley fire, we were on that. We were up for 38 hours straight, first couple days. You were chasing all these homes that were catching fire, trying to put them out, try to save as many as you can, trying to triage which houses were going to be able to be saved, other ones that weren't.
In preparation for the red flag, they hadn't just laid out their gear. They'd actually driven around and explored the steep, windy roads around them. And they'd identified big open areas they could pull their trucks back to if everything went wrong. Captain Eric Tucker.
So it's kind of like you're like a doomsday predictor. And you're trying to pick like the worst case scenario. And then are you still safe?
Just a few weeks before, Kimura and his teammates had had a scary experience on the Tick Fire. They were in a narrow valley trying to protect a house when all of a sudden a wall of flames started to close in behind them faster than they thought it would.
We rolled up all the hose. We drove up the dirt road. The fire was licking the engine. We actually burned a couple stickers, melted a light, and made it 15, 30 seconds later, we would have been driving through fire.
It's clear. These fires can be super dangerous, which is always at the back of these firefighters' minds. But that doesn't necessarily always resonate with normal folks. Chief Cabrera told me that sometimes they'll show up at a house, see someone who's ignored an evacuation order, clad in fire gear, planning on making a solo stand against flames.
It's difficult. We try to let the guys know around us, hey, this guy's committed. He's going to stay. It's his property. He's going to protect it. We do warn them that the ultimate danger is them dying. And usually when you say that you may die, their face changes a little bit. And we've had that conversation with people and they've said, yeah, I think it's time to go.
By 11 o'clock, I got kicked out so that Strike Team 1103 could get their sleep, which was a good move because at 6 a.m. the next morning, they had to hop up, get dressed, and rush off to Simi Valley. The Easy Fire had broken out and it was threatening the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. The good news is that it was not a Wolseley fire repeat. After a lot of work, 1103 and loads of other firefighters were able to get it under control quickly, all before it even broke 2,000 acres. Covering science, I'm Jacob Margolis. Girl.
All right, I've been hearing all day about how the UK will be the first country to roll out a coronavirus vaccine next week. Here at home, California could be getting some doses late this month. It's really been a breakneck pace to have these vaccines this fast. Find out how U.S. military veterans have played a key part once again, finding another way to serve. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. Britain has become the first country today to authorize emergency use of a coronavirus vaccine, with the elderly and nursing home residents getting first priority starting as early as next week. Meanwhile, a federal advisory panel on Tuesday recommended that when use is approved in the U.S., healthcare workers should get it first. It's expected that some states, including us here in California, will get doses of vaccines at some point this month. And when it comes to the testing and trials of the vaccines and other treatments for COVID-19, more than 50 Department of Veterans Affairs medical centers are involved, and the agency is calling on vets to volunteer. Stephanie Colombini reports for the American Homefront Project.
Retired Colonel Herminio Blas Irisarri spent 26 years in the Army parachuting from planes, disposing bombs, and traveling to dangerous parts of the world. Now he's seeing a different kind of threat, COVID-19. When doctors at the Tampa VA hospital told him they were starting a vaccine trial in November, he wasted no time before signing up.
It's something I want to do for my country. Not only for my country, for the entire humanity, because 7.5 billion people in this world needs this vaccine.
The Tampa VA is studying a single-dose vaccine developed by Johnson & Johnson. Blas got his shot just before Thanksgiving. He had a 50-50 chance of getting the vaccine or a placebo, but suspects he got the real deal. Blas described the injection as slow and painful and says that evening he had a headache, chills, and night sweats. But the next day,
I ran my 5 miles on the treadmill like nothing. Fine.
Blas is one of thousands of volunteers around the world taking part in the Johnson & Johnson trial. Here at the Tampa VA, Director of Infectious Disease Research, Dr. John Toney, says they're hoping to get 400 veterans. He's heard similar thoughts about the desire to serve from the dozens who've signed up so far, but says they need a lot more people. Toney knows with promising vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna already on the horizon, some people may be tempted to just wait for those to become available. But he says it's crucial to have a variety of options.
We need this. We're going to need this to get more people immunized quicker than if we only have two vaccines. We're going to wait a lot longer if we don't have additional vaccines.
Another hurdle in recruiting volunteers is the study lasts 2 years. This is important to learning how long the vaccine lasts. But Toney says it can seem daunting, especially for people wondering if they'll get the placebo.
That makes people very anxious. They don't want to go 2 years and not get a vaccine. That's happening with all the vaccines at this point. And they really don't want people to just drop out of the study and then get another vaccine.
But Toney says people won't be left hanging even if they get a placebo. Once this vaccine or another proves effective, those in the placebo group will likely get a chance to take it. Colonel Blas says he's committed to sticking with the study. At 49, he considers himself a healthy guy, but knows he could still get the coronavirus. He could also have unexpected side effects from the vaccine down the road. Those are risks he's willing to take.
I'm not afraid of anything. Well, I'm afraid of my mom.
And she wasn't happy her son was participating in this trial. Blas says many of his Puerto Rican and Colombian family members reacted with fear when he told them what he'd done. He says it's a cultural thing related to barriers in language and access to care, but also from mistrust.
Because there has been a history of medically tested that is questionable.
Dr. Tony says past medical abuses by white scientists against Hispanic, Black, and Native American people are partially why it's been difficult to get more diversity in all the vaccine trials. But with COVID-19 disproportionately affecting people of color, it's critical to know these vaccines work for them.
We would think that they would be just as effective in those populations, but without data, we don't know.
Blas is urging fellow Hispanics and all vets to volunteer.
Please help us. And when I say us, it's us as Americans. This vaccine will save our lives, and we never stop serving.
Time will tell if this vaccine does in fact protect people from the coronavirus, but Blas says he's proud to have helped find out. I'm Stephanie Colombini in Tampa.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. One win for overstretched healthcare workers right now is that the California Department of Public Health this week recommended regular weekly COVID testing for all of those employed in hospitals. The California Report's Polly Stryker has more.
It's a recommendation that makes Deborah Berger, an RN in Sonoma and president of National Nurses United, very happy. She says the union lobbied for it for months.
I think what really brought it to a head was seeing that football teams were being tested on a daily basis, yet people that were dealing with COVID in hospital settings weren't getting tested.
Berger says regular testing is vital to protect nurses, patients, and the community from the spread of COVID-19. While not a mandate, the State Department of Public Health strongly recommends the weekly testing starting December 14th. A spokeswoman for the California Hospital Association says it's concerned the testing could put a huge strain on hospitals during the surge. For the California Report, I'm Polly Stryker.
During the pandemic, schools throughout Los Angeles are relying on technology such as Zoom to reach even the youngest students at home. But as KPCC's Mariana Dale reports, one San Gabriel Valley district is also using an old school method of communication.
5-year-old Noah Fonseca is ripping into a manila envelope that's just arrived in the mail for him from his school, Roland Elementary. His mom, Maria, sent us this video. He immediately points to each word on the book's cover.
It says, my what? My papa has a motorcycle.
Do you love it?
Woo! Yeah.
At the beginning of the year, Fonseca worried her son would fall behind in online kindergarten, but she says she feels supported now.
I love the fact that the school has worked with us, getting them the tools that they need.
The book Noah got is one example of the packages the Roland Unified School District is sending to its 900 kindergartners every 2 weeks. Superintendent Julie Mitchell says she was on board with the idea as soon as teachers pitched it last spring.
Who doesn't like to get mail? Everybody likes to get mail. And when you're 5, mail is amazing.
The district paid for the materials and shipping with federal funds to mitigate learning loss during the pandemic. Noah's teacher, Ashley McGrath, thought about her own experience growing up as she and her colleagues decided what exactly to send the students. Her family immigrated from Vietnam, and a lot of the time, her grandmother took care of her.
In third grade, I remember getting detention because I did my homework in pen because I didn't have a pencil at home. So we wanted to make sure that kids would have everything that they needed.
At Roland Elementary, the majority of kids come from low-income families. So the packages include basic supplies like paper and pens in addition to books and other little surprises.
We had to invent the process as we went along because we'd never really done this in such a large quantity.
Purchasing Director Rosanna McLeod wrangled staff from across the district to procure, package, and stamp the parcels. Every item in them connects to the kindergarten curriculum, like the Slinkies included last month.
The one thing that you will need today is your super, super special stretching out Slinky.
Ashley McGrath's class recently met via Zoom for a lesson on writing.
let's go ahead and write the word books. Oh, wait. Writers.
She frowns.
I don't think I know how to spell the word books. I'm just going to give up. Forget it. I'm just going to give up. Oh, my gosh. Did you hear that? Writers. I heard so many writers said, don't give up. They said, stretch out your words.
She pulls out a traffic cone orange slinky.
Books. Ready? Books. Books.
McGrath stretches the slinky apart as she talks, and the kids mimic her motions. Physical materials like these slinkies can be an important part of learning. Wendy Osteroff teaches educators about cognitive development and neuroscience at Sonoma State University. She says the most effective lessons engage different senses.
Then the next time when you have to think about stretching out a word, if you have a visceral experience of using your body and using the slinky to do that, then you can think of it as just activation of more parts of the brain.
So these tools can help students reach their academic goals. Teacher Ashley McGrath says that above all else, though, she wants students to feel safe and loved at school. This is how she ends her Zoom lesson.
Okay, I love you, I love you, I love you. I love you, Lexi. Bye. I love you, Julian.
Bye.
She makes sure to say each student's name. It's how every class ends, whether it's in person or online.
I love you, bye.
Covering early childhood, I'm Mariana Dale.
All right, for just a second, picture yourself at the Academy Awards and you hear this. And the Oscar goes to them. You imagine hearing that sometime in the future? With actor Elliot Page's announcement this week that he's transgender, talk about a genderless award show is now getting a little bit louder. Coming up, though, we'll hear how likely that is. That's next when Take Two continues.
I love you so. Please hold. All the leaves are brown, and the sky is gray. I went for a walk on a winter's day. I'd be saving warm if I was in L.A.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC, and you can also find us on Apple Podcasts. I'm E. Martinez. Ed Asner leads a lawsuit against SAG-AFTRA, the union he once led. The Sundance Film Festival is coming to you this year, and what's up with Hillbilly Elegy? All that and more in this week's installment of On the Lot.
Hey, stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Joining us, as always, is Rebecca Keegan, senior editor for film for The Hollywood Reporter. All right, Rebecca, so let's start with this lawsuit that Emmy-winning actor Ed Asner is leading. So why are he and other members of SAG-AFTRA suing their very own union?
Well, in August, SAG-AFTRA announced changes to their health plan that dramatically raised the number of hours a person has to work in order to be eligible to receive the benefit. This sparked a huge uproar at the time when it was announced, with people noting that most actors have spent 2020 unable to work due to the pandemic, with theaters closed and production shut down for so much of the year. So it's a horrible time to introduce these new requirements. Months later now, Asner and others are suing the Guild, alleging, among other things, age discrimination in the way these new rules are being applied.
So what's at risk then for Ed Asner and the other plaintiffs here?
Well, Asner, who's 91 and the lead plaintiff, is a former SAG president, a current member of the SAG-AFTRA National Board. He's going to lose his coverage when the changes take effect because he'll not reach the new qualifying earnings threshold, according to his lawsuit. For the way the new rules work is that members who are 65 or older are no longer able to use their residuals income to qualify for the threshold if they're taking a union pension.
So why is SAG-AFTRA making these changes to their health care plan qualifications now? I mean, is it related to the pandemic and the financial troubles? I mean, that seems like the simple answer. Is that what's going on?
Well, when SAG announced these changes, they said without them, they would be facing a deficit of $141 million this year, $83 million in 2021, and by 2024, the health plan would run out of reserves. They attributed that to soaring healthcare costs across the board, with the economic stresses of the pandemic being just a part of the larger problem. Another source of the financial problems, say some actors, is SAG's merger with AFTRA in 2017, and that at that time of that merger, the union was not clear on how it would be affected.
I remember that, Rebecca. That was a kind of a dicey, sticky time because, you know, there's two unions, they got together and everyone's, so what happens now? And no one kind of had a good answer at the moment.
Right. And there was that sort of kicking the tires experience that the unions had when they were considering merging. And among the allegations from the folks in Asner's camp is that SAG didn't kick the tires enough in looking at what the impact would be on their health plan.
You know, Rebecca, for a second, I thought, I got my SAG card now. I can act in any... No, but that was not the case.
Well, not this year. Not, you know, this year, even like Meryl Streep is staying home.
Yeah. So, okay. So Ed Asner and the other plaintiffs filed a lawsuit in federal court yesterday. So what could we expect to happen with this case?
Well, this is a class action suit with 10 participants right now. And what they're seeking is a declaration that members of SAG's board breached their fiduciary duties in passing these new rules. And the members of the class action suit want to have the losses restored to the plan.
All right. You know, last week, Rebecca, I was on vacation. I was just kind of staying home, just doing a lot of nothing. I walked into my bedroom and my wife was watching something on TV. I said, "Hey, what you watching?" She says, "Hillbilly Elegy." I thought, "Oh, what's that?" She's like, "It's good. It's just really heavy." I did a U-turn and went back to watch The Avengers because I didn't want anything heavy. I work in news enough already. But let's listen to a clip. This is a Netflix movie starring Amy Adams and Glenn Close.
You got to take care of business. You got to go to school. You got to get good grades to even have a chance.
Mom was the best in her class. What's the point?
I'm talking about a chance. You might not make it, but you sure as hell won't if you don't try.
Why do you even care what I do?
I ain't going to live forever.
Yeah, hear that? It's heavy. Now, the film is getting a lot of viewers, but it's also been accused by some critics as being too Hollywoodified. What's the story and what's the criticism about?
Right. Well, so this movie is based on J.D. Vance's memoir about growing up poor in Southern Ohio, the son of a drug addict played by Amy Adams, raised largely by his feisty grandmother from Kentucky, played by Glenn Close. That's whose voice you heard talking to Vance in the clip we just heard. Ultimately, you know, J.D. Vance goes on to attend Yale Law School and becomes a real kind of up by his bootstraps success story. Critics largely have not liked this film. Vox's Alyssa Wilkinson wrote that it was, quote, distractingly Hollywoodified, a rich person's idea of what it's like to be a poor person, a tone-deaf attempt to assuage a very particular kind of liberal guilt.
Oh, you know, 3 hours later, when I walked back into my bedroom, my wife said, yeah, you wouldn't like it.
It is heavy, as she said. It leans a lot on the problems of this particular family, but the memoir was a bestseller, and I think a lot of people have sought out the movie because of that.
You know, and
also because of the two big stars in it, obviously.
Yeah. And there's been this question of this kind of a political disconnect between the film and the memoirist who it's based on. So can you explain that?
Yeah, in Vance's memoir, he expands his story to make some broader cultural and political observations about the white working class. He's critical of people who rely on welfare, for instance, and spend money on things that he considers frivolous. Like in the book, there's a scene where Vance's character is working at a grocery store. He, at that time, can't afford a phone. People are coming to the grocery store, talking on a cell phone and paying with, food stamps. And so he became kind of a spokesperson in some ways, in some ways willing spokesperson for white working class voters who had voted for Trump. And the book became a bestseller around the time of Trump's election. The movie does not engage in the broader political ideas of the book, and that was really by design. Director Ron Howard has said that he wanted to focus on the relationships in the book not some of the larger political themes.
Now, to be clear, Rebecca, I can handle heavy film topics, just not on vacation. Just not when I'm taking time away from the heaviness of this job.
I hear that.
So there
I
you
hear
go.
That.
We're talking on the lot with Rebecca Keegan, senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Now, okay, Sundance Film Festival, that takes place every January and February in Park City, Utah. Normally you go, right, Rebecca? Don't you go all the time?
I do often go to Sundance, yes.
Okay, not this year, obviously. So what's the plan? It's it's happening, but not just in Utah.
Right. Well, so Sundance 2020 was the last major film festival before the pandemic. Safe to say that Sundance 2021 will reflect the very different world we're living in now. It'll happen January 28th through February 3rd and be largely virtual, with some in-person events happening at drive-ins around the country, including here in LA at the Rose Bowl and the Vineland drive-in. It'll be shorter than usual, 7 days instead of 11. I'll have about 70 feature films. And that's scaled down from a usual year. I mean, one of the hallmarks of the Sundance experience is waiting in line in the cold for a movie and talking to other cinephiles.
Yes.
I won't miss the cold, but I will miss the conversation. And Sundance is making some accommodation for that. There'll be virtual waiting rooms before the screening starts. So you can be in there and maybe run into a friend or colleague and chat and approximate some of the spirit that makes Sundance fun.
I want to go to Park City. I want to mingle with the beautiful people. You know, people won't be able to tell the difference between me and the beautiful people. So I want to be there. But, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, with Park, everybody looks the same, which is very, you know,
that's
democratizing.
True. It's cold. So, yeah, no one can tell. All right. Now, moving on to one more topic. Yesterday, the Oscar-nominated star of the 2007 movie Juno came out as trans. Elliot Page wrote on social media about the freedom of the moment, but also acknowledged the violence against many trans people that really exists in our society today. So, Rebecca, what do you make of both how Page came out and also what this could mean for other people in and out of Hollywood?
Well, like other celebrities these days, Page used his social media platforms to communicate this news. That's different from, say, Caitlyn Jenner, who came out as trans in the pages of Vanity Fair, or Laverne Cox, who had already transitioned when she became a public figure. But I think every time a public figure does this, it does become easier for those who follow, whether it's Ellen DeGeneres breaking ground in the 90s or Elliot Page today. But for many people, their first experience of a trans person is a celebrity. So it's not only a kind of important event in the life of Elliot Page, but it's definitely meaningful in the broader culture.
And arguably, Elliot Page is the biggest name to have done this. I mean, I can't really think of anyone
else. For sure.
No.
Oscar nominated as an actor. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, was there anything in the statement about plans that Page has for any upcoming acting or producing work?
Not in Page's statement, but Netflix, which airs The Umbrella Academy, quickly tweeted in reply to Page's statement, quote, "So proud of our superhero. We love you, Elliot. Can't wait to see you return in season 3. So obviously he's going to be back on the show. The streaming company is also changing Page's name in the credits on the show.
You know, his announcement reminded me of a piece in the New York Times from last year about how the Oscars, Emmys, and Tony Awards are not prepared to honor non-binary actors and people who use pronouns such as they or them. And Page's pronouns are he and they. Rebecca, wondering what we know about how or even if Hollywood is maybe rethinking gender-based awards categories for acting.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, the way the major academies have handled it so far is that they ask the person to choose whether they want to be considered an actor or actress, or supporting actor or supporting actress. It's definitely something that people are thinking about as the conversation is evolving in Hollywood. One of the, you know, questions it raises is why on earth acting categories are separated by gender at all. There is not sort of any really logical reason for it. It's not like basketball, like Meryl Streep can slam dunk, but Denzel Washington can't or something. I mean, it's just there is no major gender difference in the way people act. So I think it's something that the academies will be continuing to look at.
If I am aware, let me see, there is no Pulitzer for best male writer, right? That doesn't exist. Yeah.
Right. I mean, one of the things that some people have raised that could be a problem if the academies were to scrap gendered categories is that women would get fewer nominations because they do get fewer film and TV roles historically.
That's Rebecca Keegan, senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All All right, think of all of your favorite podcasts. Chances are none of them are in Spanish. However, that could be changing with Chile leading the Latin American podcast wave. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and most places where you get your podcasts. I'm Ian Martinez. It's a time of the week when we visit with Nick Kwa. He's the go-to source for all things about the podcast industry, and he's also host of the LAS Studios podcast, Servant of Pod. Now, this week, Nick travels virtually beyond the bounds of the United States to meet the duo behind a Chilean podcast. It's called Las Raras, and it's a narrative documentary show that's almost completely in Spanish.
Historias de libertad. Sus protagonistas y paisajes sonoros. Esto es Las Raras Podcast.
The creators of Las Raras Podcast are Catalina May and Martin Cruz. So, all right, Nick, so what is Las Raras about?
It's kind of a mix between kind of a narrative audio documentary show, something in the style of Snap Judgment or This American Life, a mix of that and an art house project. And like you teed up, it's almost completely in Spanish, and Maya and Cruz typically gravitate around stories about outsiders and people who live on the fringes that generally are engaged in the struggle of challenging the status quo. There's a lot to do with protest and liberation in this show. But here's a clip of how Martin describes the show.
I think that the protagonists that we seek are usually outsiders in a way, people that somehow are resisting the norms or challenging the statu quo and fighting for social justice. Also, their stories are not usually represented in mainstream media. So in that way, also, they are outsiders. I mean, we look for stories that are a lot of the times very intimate stories, very personal stories. And usually these stories are like in the margins of society, maybe, and also the media.
You know, Nick, I got to say, I know that all of these stories, you know, they cross cultures. I mean, there are stories from all around the world. I'm just so glad and happy, Nick, is that we're hearing these stories in Spanish, because I knew they existed, but I just, you know, it's funny. We get so bogged down in our own personal little worlds that sometimes we don't even reach out. And I'm so glad to hear that these stories are being told in Spanish, because it's one of those things that it can get lost.
Absolutely. And it's kind of like one of the sort of the interesting give and takes of the internet, right? Like it's really wide. It's really, you know, democratic in terms of who gets to publish and be able to sort of deliver these stories, but sometimes you gotta really look for it. And Las Raras, I think, you know, they've been around since 2015, and they've been telling stories like this for a while. And it took them, I think, a little bit of sort of structural support to sort of like kind of bubble up in terms of just awareness. But they've been at this work for a while.
How would you describe the sound of the show?
The sound of the show is very considered, and I think the way to really sort of get that across is the fact that Martin is a sound designer by trade. He's also a musician. He works on things like video projects and video games, just making music and creating soundscapes and things like that. And so as a result, Las Raras is very sound forward. There's a lot of underground tape, but also a lot of sort of subjective music and sort of sound effects and kind of these, they like to create these sort of ethereal atmospheric feelings. And that comes across, you know, in any episode you pick up from the show. It's like listening to an art house project.
Now, you mentioned Martin is a sound engineer. Tell us more about Cruz and his co-host, Catalina May.
So Catalina is a longtime journalist and an academic. She's written for places like The Guardian and for several other websites and things like that. And at some point in her history, she published a fairly influential independent weekly in Chile called The Clinic. And as discussed, Martin is a sound designer, he's a musician, and he's also an aerial cinematographer. So, you know, they're really close collaborators. They're a couple, and it, you know, it's one of those things where I think they support each other artistically in really interesting ways.
We're talking to Nick Kwa. He's the host of the LAS Studios podcast, Servant of Pod. Nick, since you opened the door to a Latin American podcast, what's the industry like these days? And who are the kinds of people making the podcast in Latin America?
So the way that Catalina and Martin tell it, and I'm basing all this almost completely on their account of what the scene looks like in Latin America,
sure.
Is that it's still pretty largely defined by the big radio conglomerates there. And this kind of tracks with what, you know, what reports have been pulling over the years about that part of the world. And my understanding is that whatever podcast scene there is tends to be clustered around stuff that those conglomerates either repackage for the medium or, you know, try to recreate their formulas for this on-demand audio format. But I'm also broadly aware that there are, you know, groups of independent artists and producers using Medium to create different kinds of work, often smaller and more experimental. And, you know, much like the, you know, how you're trying to find something niche or experimental on the internet, you really got to poke around and look for it.
So their style, what they do, this narrative documentary podcast, how does Las Raras a podcast fit into the shows that are being done in Latin America? And how unique is their style in comparison?
It's, you know, pretty unique in comparison, like compared to other narrative podcasts that we're aware of, that, you know, are popular in the States. But the more sort of fundamental aspects of the format, documentary style, narrative, nonfiction, often using really sophisticated soundscapes, that my understanding is that that's still pretty rare in Latin America and among Latin American podcast production. Part of this is just due to the resources that's, you know, and the audiences available for that, just like the expectations in those markets. But one thing that's really interesting about Las Raras when you kind of listen to it is that it takes a lot of language from, or just production language from kind of Western documentary style audio a little bit. Like you can sort of hear the cadence, you can sort of feel the very similar sort of styles of narration and approaching that style. And I asked them a little bit about this, about whether the style that they have is common and why they think that might not be the case. And this is what they have to say about that.
In the Spanish-speaking world, there are not many audio producers.
Hmm.
Because it's a new medium, so there is no a long tradition of audio production in Spanish. I mean, the style that we work, like documentary style.
In Chile, for example, that I can say at least, we don't have public radio. So we don't have that kind of tradition and that mindset of the US has.
You know, Martin mentioned how in Chile there is no public radio. I mean, the whole country is more than welcome to make Take Two their official public radio show for the nation of Chile. I'm more than willing to be the ambassador to make that connection. Now, Nick, one more thing. Is there an audience for Spanish language or bilingual English Spanish podcasts in the United States?
There absolutely is. We're only beginning to really get studies on this for the first time over the past year or so. But Edison Research recently published a report specifically trying to figure out and size how many American-based listeners or Latino listeners consume podcasts that are primarily in Spanish. And I think they found like 24% or 25% of U.S. Latinos have ever listened to a podcast that was mostly in Spanish. So that says a little bit about something about the demand and says a little bit something about the supply. And in terms of what's available, there's a growing pie for sure. NPR's Radio Ambulante is one of the first sort of major institutions trying to sort of build that bridge in terms of language and geography. But we've also seen a couple of other companies sprout up trying to sort of tackle that US-based Spanish language podcast market. There's a company called Evolver that I think has a relationship with iHeartMedia that's working in this space. And then there are also other public radio efforts. I think there was kind of a bilingual soap opera-style drama that KCRW made a couple of years ago called Celestial Blood that got a bit of attention and fanfare.
I mean, Nick, I'm even willing to change the name of the show to Toma Dos. You know, I can use my real name, Jorge Luis Martinez. I mean, there's so much I can do for the nation of Chile. All they have to do is ask. Nick Kwa is a host of the LAS Studios podcast, Servant of Pod. New episodes are out every Wednesday, and you can find it on Apple Podcasts, which conveniently is also where you can get the Take Two podcast. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And the whole show is there wherever you get your podcast. You can take it in one big 49-minute dose. You can take a walk around the block if it takes you 49 minutes to hear the whole show, or just break it up in individual segments. It's all there, so please go find it if you want it. You can also find us on social media. We're on Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. Good for Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.